Namaste. Good morning, everyone. A few days ago, I had the privilege to meet a lady who is about 80 years old, and her story was quite fascinating. But the part I would like to share is this. She was from a very wealthy family, extremely wealthy, high up in the social circles in India. And life was all about parties, holidays, wondering what to wear for the next event, and so on. Till she received a phone call one morning saying that her brother had collapsed and died in the bathroom. And in that instant, the unreality of the life she was living hit her so hard that it started her spiritual journey. Thereafter, she followed a particular practice, a particular sadhana, which is based on mantras. That became her journey. And over time, of course, the social circles she was in tried to pull her back into it, get her involved back into all these activities. And she simply had no interest anymore. Now she gives a lot of her time to those who are interested in her practice and want to imbibe it and follow it. Her time is given for that. So as Ramana Maharshi said, it usually takes a blow in life, and if not the first blow, then the second or the third, to wake up and come on to the spiritual path. You see, this realm of duality is the realm of objects. The child is given toys, objects, fascinated with these toys, and one toy replaces another and another and another. The child is sucked into the object. Yet the child ego has no value assigned to the object, unlike an adult. The adult ego knows a Rolex watch has a certain value, and let's say a cheaper brand does not have that value. So in fact, now the object is burdened by the value assigned to it, and the adult derives its sense of self from that value placed on the object. So I want to be seen with a fancy watch. Whether I myself like that watch or not, no longer becomes relevant. Because now, as an adult, I derive my sense of self from an object which has a value upon it. This tends to happen, depending, of course, on the circles one is moving in. And then we value those who are able to have those expensive objects too. It is very subtle how this creeps up on us, the assignment of values to objects. And then we get enthralled in this world of objects. This is the Maya. This is the way it is designed. Till the realization happens, what am I deriving my sense of self from? Something external to me, something that is transient, comes and goes. I buy one nice watch today, I get bored of it, buy another one after 6 months, and so on and so forth. So this enthrallment in objects is what creates suffering. The sage may walk across a shop window and see a beautiful object which appeals to him, and may spontaneously decide whether or not to buy it, depending on what resources he has. We don't know. There are no golden rules here that the sage will not buy this and not buy that. We don't know. But the attachment to the object and the sense of self that is derived from that object does not operate. So what happens? He buys a fancy watch, maybe enjoys it. Someone else appreciates it so much, he may just take it off and give it away. Because the sage lives in spontaneity. At the same time, He may see a watch which does not cost much money at all and loves it equally. He will not hesitate to wear that. That is what happens, you see. So when we are clear and when we are not identified with these objects which define us, then there is no suffering created for ourselves. And Joel Goldsmith pointed out something quite beautiful. Where do these objects come from? Now you may go into the background of the object and say it started in mineral form, someone sculpted it, did this, went into a factory, that in linear time. That is the logical left brain explanation of where the object came from. But isn't it a fact, as far as you are concerned, first the object was not in your consciousness, and then it appeared in your consciousness? This is an important point. First, there was no awareness of a particular object, and then it was brought into awareness. So as far as you are concerned, the object literally appeared out of nowhere, as he would call it, out of the infinite invisible. Everything we experience in our day, the people we meet, the things we see, they just appear on the screen of consciousness. But that infinite invisible, that screen of consciousness is relegated to the background. That is why Bhagwan Raman Maharshi said, let come what comes, let go what goes, and see what remains. This pure being, this pure presence is always ever there, within which arises manifestations of various kinds, most of which pull us into stories stretched in the duration of time. So we lose this quality of witnessing because we get involved, and that involvement is what starts creating suffering. Life is about relationships, whether it is relationships with people in our lives, with objects in our lives, with events in our lives, our relationship with our own thoughts, relationship, in relation with. So when we say, are our relationships harmonious or not, we are not referring only to interpersonal relationships. It is referring to all this, our relationship to objects. Because if everything is appearing within my field of consciousness, then truly nothing is apart from me. It is not appearing outside my consciousness. So how do I relate to that which is appearing within my consciousness? Because if it is not apart from me, then it is my relationship with an aspect of myself. This is the first understanding. Nothing is really apart from me. So the person I love and the person I hate are both appearances within consciousness. When I accept the hand of God behind everyone, everyone being shaped by their conditioning, which God created, by their genetics, which God created, by their nature, which God created, then I realize that there is truly nobody to hate. It may appear like that. With this realization comes the acceptance of people the way God created them. I will still do what I think and feel I should do in a particular equation. But when I see that nobody is truly the doer of their actions, then the sting of doership is pulled out from the equation and there is no room for hate. When I see everyone in this light, what happens is that my relationship is no longer with people anymore. It is with God. So I am less and less enthralled in this game, be it people, be it objects, be it an event in my life. I am no longer assigning and trying to rationalize an event The first understanding that dawns is it could have happened only if it was the will of God. So I am no longer battling with why is this happening? It should not be happening. It happened. Thereafter, I deal with the situation the best way I can, knowing that even the outcome is not in my hands. So this becomes the way I deal with my life, my attitude to life. And I find by and by that I'm more at peace than I was before. And I find by and by I'm not taking away another's peace of mind like I used to before. If we are honest with ourselves and sit back and reflect on the things we say to others and the things we do, much of it is directed at taking away their peace. I don't know if I mentioned this before, but Osho said something in his classic style about, first he talked about women, the women in his life, and how he said when they tried to make him happy, the problem was he was already happy. So he said it was quite a difficult situation because out of all good intentions, they were trying to make him happy. But he said, I couldn't be happier than I was. And then sometimes seeing this, they would try to make him unhappy. Now, he may have said this in a lighter vein, but this is very important. For us, it is very important because we can see, are we trying to make other people unhappy because we are unhappy? The ego works in very subtle ways and in very subtle dimensions. On the spiritual journey, there's a complete recalibration. As my teacher would say, the only measure is peace of mind. How do I know whether a teaching has impacted me or not? By the degree of peace I feel in daily life. That is it. That is why I remember perhaps the first and only time I sat in front of him in the hot seat where you could ask questions. I was 29 maybe. He asked me, what do you want most in life? Self-realization. And I had a blank look. I had never heard that word before. He said, all right, enlightenment. And again, I had a blank look. So I said, I'm really sorry. I don't know what these words mean. And he said, it's okay. Don't worry about it. All that a human being is looking for, forget these words. All that a human being is looking for, whether they know it or not, is peace of mind. I received a couple of questions on email, which I'd like to take up now. And thereafter, if anyone would like to ask something or share something, you're most welcome to. This question is about Dad's untimely death. My dad, 62, passed away last month. You had explained in one of your videos 4 years ago about the acceptance of a beloved's passing. It's very difficult for me to accept this. I have stopped following and worshipping my guru. I was continuously chanting his name and a mantra given by him. Still, it didn't save my dad. Those scenes at the ICU of the last 2-3 days are not disappearing from my mind and eyes. If possible, kindly help and guide me to overcome this thing. I have a young family ahead of me. This incident is compelling me to part ways with spirituality. Acceptance of a beloved's passing is indeed difficult. Yet, by not accepting it, we create tremendous suffering. The other day, someone mentioned about an author, a Western author, saying how a family member's death, for example, should be a celebration, a joyful celebration. So be it. That's a beautiful approach too. But sometimes when a relationship is very close, you can't help but feel sad about it and grieve about it. That is natural for that person. For someone else, it may be a celebration which is natural. You see, this is not a one-size-fits-all approach. It takes time to heal. Some heal faster, others take more time. But as my teacher would say, grief does not convert to mourning in the duration of time. That is the difference. Grief, which is pure grief which arises, does not get stretched in the duration of time. That is the involvement. Now, in this case, coming to the guru, I do not know from this question whether the guru gave a guarantee that the father would be saved, or was it an assumption on part of the person who has written this mail. To me, it is highly unlikely that any guru would give such a guarantee, because the guru knows that each one's destiny is in the hands of the higher power. Yet there have been stories where there's an intervention of the guru in a certain way. There are exceptions to this rule, but even that happens. So, you see, I was very fortunate. I went to a teacher, and perhaps the entire lineage was such. You really could not go to them with your personal problems and ask them to solve it. I tried it once with Ramesh. I had a problem at work. A very delicate situation with a client when I was in advertising. I went to him, presented it to him, and he said, we'll see what happens. That's it. It was always just see what happens. Any situation, that was the answer. And whatever happens is the will of God. And I'm so grateful, because that gave me the strength to face whatever challenges came, rather than looking for an outcome which I think might be best for me. This teaching, that is why Ramesh would say, even Maharaj said, it is the teaching of the last resort, a total surrender, total acceptance of what is the will of God, and that nobody is the doer of their actions. Now, of course, it is trauma, right? You see your loved one in the ICU. The loved one has passed away. It is going to play in your mind. That is also natural. You're going to relive that moment again and again and again. The brain works that way. And then with the passage of time, you feel that that is also fading out from consciousness and coming up once in a while. So everything has to be allowed. You cannot stop something from appearing which is appearing. That creates more suffering. It is a natural process. And such incidents, if you lose faith in your spiritual journey, means you felt you could control outcomes, including your dad's passing. So the sense of doership is so strong. I didn't get the desired outcome I wanted. That is extreme suffering, being created for yourself and everyone else. The sense of doership has got further enhanced. I think I thought I could save my dad. I thought my guru could save my dad. It is this, precisely this sense of doership, which destroys, shatters our peace of mind. And when we accept a beloved's passing, pain is bound to be there. Images are bound to come. Everything is accepted. It is all accepted as the will of God. And by, with the passage of time, life takes over. I get involved with my family, my work. And there's a natural progression of time. The sense of doership is indeed that which compounds our suffering. This too shall pass. All my loved and cherished relationships are transient. I too am transient. That is the design of life. Day turns to night. The next email. I have been following the teachings for some time and have a couple of questions. My first question is centered around the side effect of understanding the spiritual path and following practices. On my journey so far, I have had long, blissful moments of outer clarity with inner quiet. However, I find that my working memory, which is the ability to remember minute details, has been affected somehow. I am not sure if this is because of practices based on thought negation, like meditation, self-inquiry, and witnessing in daily living, or just a sense of attention deficiency, ADHD, creeping in due to modern-day distractions on the phone and off it. I was wondering if there's a relationship between going deeper into the self and the memory recall getting weaker as a result. I would appreciate your thoughts on the matter. You see, memory is memory. The memory cannot get weaker in that sense because everything is registered and recorded in consciousness. In fact, if one follows, let's say, a particular kriya, a breath technique or practice, it can sharpen the memory, because there's more prana being infused into the body and there's more clarity as a result. Oxygen levels are greater and so on. So it cannot be that memory failing is due to a spiritual practice in that sense. Yet, what could happen is that one has lost interest in the mundane or losing interest in the mundane, which means the attention I would place on certain things, I no longer place it on those things to that degree. So, recalling those from memory is no longer my priority, so to speak, because there has been a shift. It is not that the memory has become weaker. There has been a shift. Now, of course, as we all know, attention deficit, ADHD, is a big thing now. Fragmentation, because the consciousness is so fragmented, so many things coming on the smartphone, so many videos, so many distractions, television, streaming, so on and so forth. So fragmentation of attention is happening, which actually, thankfully, our generation and earlier than that didn't have to deal with. It was far easier to be in the moment without all that than it is today, no doubt about it. So attention is being fragmented. That fragmentation takes a lot of energy. Multitasking, seeing many things at the same time, many inputs, sensory inputs, eyes being used all the time to look at the screen, so much more to remember, so much more to absorb. That is more likely it. All right. We can take questions now. Yes, Vandana.
Good morning, Gautam.
Good morning. How are you?
All well, thank you. My question is very simple, but very difficult to practice. How does one get free from the burden of thoughts?
We have to get free from the one who wants to get free from the burden of thoughts. You see, Vandana, it is not so much the burden of the thoughts, but my involvement in them. I get involved in the thoughts, take delivery of them, and then that becomes a burden because I identify with all that. So when I accept this about myself, this is for anyone. Thoughts come, thoughts go, some are taken delivery of. Which is it which is causing me suffering and taking me away from my peace? That is what I have to look at. And thoughts which are a burden are generally thoughts of what someone said or did to me. When we really look during the day what thoughts arose, what happened, and we find there is this me center, which is based on the foundation is doership, attributing it to someone else or to myself, that can become a burden. When my thinking mind is unnecessarily engaged in the dead past or an imaginary future, that is a burden. So all that part is the burden, which is taking me away from simply pure presence and being. Now, if my working mind is engaged, that's not a burden because it's operating in the present moment. So we have to ask ourselves, this burden of thoughts, of what quality are they? Why are they a burden? If I find that I am repeating a story in my mind all the time about what someone said or someone did, that is a burden. If I accept this happened because it was meant to happen, no burden. The burden is the involvement in the duration of time, which happens when there is a sense of doership attributed to that event. But if I find by and by, whatever happens in the day, I move on, not stuck in that happening, no burden. Does that help answer your question in any way?
It helps. I have to practice it. That's all. Mindfully.
You see, it happens. It happens. And as my teacher would say, if you just sit for 15 minutes at the end of the day and review what is it that happened and what took away your peace, just those few things maybe, and just see them in this light, that there is truly no action that I can consider mine because it depended on what I saw, tasted, heard, smelled, or touched. And same for the other. All I have to do is that. There's no further practice involved. When I accept my action or the other's action depended on factors beyond their control, I have given up the game of doership. I have seen how everything is like a Kashmiri carpet. All these weaves come together to create a grand design, which is the design of life. Everyone plays their part in it. Everything is interconnected in that sense. And that is when one big transformation happens. I no longer view life as A leads to B, B leads to C, and C leads to D. Now it's reversed. For D to happen, C had to happen. For C to happen, B had to happen. And for B to happen, A had to happen. This reversal, where I am no longer seeking a cause-effect relationship with everything that goes on in my life, is very liberating, very freeing.
Good morning.
You see, Maharaj referred to it as, in a slightly different context, reversing into the future. It's very beautiful, this phrase, because it also clears up one thing. In seeking cause-effect relationships in life, I am reliving the past. This happened, so this happened. This happened, so this. The mind loves to do that. So it's recreating the past because the past is known and familiar. But when I'm reversing into the future, that story of the past is dropped.
Mm-hmm.
It's so beautiful. It's really so beautiful when that starts happening because then my mind is no longer engaged. The left brain, which is the logical brain, analytical brain, is not obsessing over all this anymore. That is, then there, that burden of thinking is not there anymore.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, sir, Soma.
Good morning, sir. I'm Soma. My question is that sometimes in life we come across situations where we have to choose between doing less bad and more bad rather than good and bad. In such situations, it happens that our heart is filled with guilt that we have even chosen the less bad option also. And that is always in the back of our mind. So how do we deal with that?
Are you referring to the guilt which you feel because you still had to choose a bad option though it was less bad?
Yes.
Okay. You see, Soma, with this teaching, nothing changes. You still have to do precisely that which you think and feel you should do. This teaching is not going to tell you what to do and what not to do because it does not play God, right? Now you have yourself defined the situation as you had to choose one of the lesser evils, the way I understand what you are saying. We don't need to even get into what you're referring to. The point is a choice had to be made. And the choice was made for what is less bad, yet there is guilt. Now, this is a very important point, this point of guilt. I believe in one of the videos, someone put a comment that, isn't guilt also God's will? Of course it is. There's nothing which is not God's will. So feeling guilty is also God's will. But let's, for just a minute or two, look at guilt. Guilt arises because I feel I am the doer of the action. So I feel guilty of my action. You know, Soma, there are people in your life who will also try and make you feel guilty. We all have that in our life. People who try and make us feel guilty and they say, do this or. And then this burden of guilt becomes very heavy. Guilt and shame is what my teacher would say. A lot of people from the West used to come to his satsangs and they were burdened with guilt and shame. And his point was, if deep down I know I am not the doer of my actions, regret may arise. I had to do something, I had to make a choice given the situation, and I regret that life presented me only with these two options. I had to pick one. Regret may arise, no doubt. But that regret does not get converted to guilt or shame. Why? Because I know, firstly, life gave me those two options to choose from. I didn't. And I had to make a choice based on my understanding. My understanding is based on my conditioning and my nature, which God created. So if it's truly not my action, if the event or the situation which is placed before me was not my choice, then the question of guilt does not arise, not my action. Yet, I of course have to employ my buddhi, my intellect. A decision has to be made, a situation is placed before me, I have to take a call. Am I harming someone? Am I not harming someone? What is the bigger evil? What is the lesser evil? I go through that process. Why? Because it may be God's will. The action may not be mine, but certainly I have to face the consequences. I am not absolved of the consequences because I consider it as not my action. There will be consequences. So I deal with those consequences in full awareness. The only difference is my mind is at peace. Why is my mind at peace? Because there is no longer this overwhelming emotion of guilt, which is plaguing me. Regret may be in the moment. Oh God, you know, I really wish I didn't have to choose between these two. Okay, so be it. But because of the sense of doership, that is getting stretched into guilt, and I'm feeling guilty and guilty and guilty and guilty and guilty, and it is eating away into my peace. So when we understand how guilt operates, something very interesting will happen. It's not that we are going to become insensitive. We feel, oh, if I don't feel guilty, that means I don't care. I mean, no, you're getting a deeper understanding of life. But more importantly, you will become aware that do I try to make others feel guilty? Can you see the harm you could do to others by making them feel guilty? You may say even that is God's will. But we are talking here, you and me, because this is the journey of awareness. We have been brought together to understand life and emotions and how we go through them with awareness, without awareness. So when we really imbibe this teaching of non-doership, when we accept that the other is not the doer of the actions, we still have to deal with them. We still have to deal with the situation to the way we feel best. But when this whole guilt trip is not engaged in, there is peace of mind, there is clarity, and I find that I'm dealing with the situation and with the person objectively, with neutrality. I am not a guilt generator, and I am not thrusting guilt upon the others. You see, it is a very interesting mechanism, this whole guilt play, which we all engage in, something to be seen. So I'm not trying to make you happy by saying, don't feel guilty. I'm saying, let's understand what guilt is, where it comes from, why it comes. Let's look at it objectively. Does that help answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Anything else?
No, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes, Ravi.
Namaste, Gautamji.
Namaste.
In spiritual life, or spiritual journey, too much emphasis is given on watching your thoughts, right? So I just want to understand what exactly this means, because when I try to be aware of what is going on currently in this very moment, what I find is a blank, total blank. And then when the attention subsides, the thoughts start coming. And this phenomena is keep on going. So when anybody says that watch your thought, precisely what is going on in this very moment, is it ever possible, or am I doing something wrong so I'm unable to exactly know what is going on? Because when you just pinpoint what is going on right at this moment, there is blank.
I agree with you entirely.
Thank
Absolutely, I'm in
you.
full agreement with you. Yet, I would rather turn that around to what is going on in my mind. What are the thoughts which are going on within me, and what are they based on? Like, for example, I'm thinking something is overriding my thinking. A happening happened which is really bothering me. And I find I'm being drawn to that, replaying it again and again. Maybe my colleague at work said something which I don't resonate with or was upsetting to me. That is consuming my mind. My thinking is going on and on. Now, looking at that, why is this happening? That is a very beautiful process because I'm unraveling that part, not just watching thoughts. Now I'm seeing what is the content of my mind. What am I constantly thinking about, and what is that based on? Or am I at peace? And I will invariably find an event happened in the day which took my peace away. Why did it take my peace away? What was it based on? This is the process of inquiry or investigation. And this is where, when I start going through this process, I can see that my peace was taken away because of what someone said or did, the sense of doership. And when that gets unraveled, I find my thinking mind, which was so stretched into all this, is now subsiding. It's becoming quieter because I'm not looking, I'm not hating, blaming, condemning, judging. There's no pride, arrogance, guilt, shame, ill will, spite, hatred, jealousy, and on, which was earlier there. That's all falling away. It's being stripped away. So when I find my thinking mind is being really dissolved, I am more and more present to the present, more in awareness, living life each moment, each day, because I have solved this riddle, this puzzle of me versus the other, and I have healed back into the original polarity of me and the other. So watching your thoughts is in this sense what happens.
So, does this involve any kind of analysis, or just a mere spectator you are watching everything? Or you are
No,
slightly involved in analysis part also?
could be. Some people don't need to be. Now, for example, in my case, when my teacher said nobody is the doer of their actions, it was very obvious to me. For someone else, they had to sit back and understand it. What does this mean? And then he would explain it to them that, the person said something based on their conditioning, how their parents treated them as a child, the environment they grew up in, the money they had, so on and so forth. That conditioning shaped this person who is saying things a certain way. So then that person says, ah, now I understand. So that is analysis, that is investigation. That, oh, yes, now if I look at it this way, that this person is saying things based on all this, and so truly he is shaped by factors beyond his control. Ah, okay, this makes sense. So then next time someone says something, I again reflect on it in this way. So for some people, that will be the process. For others, it may not be required. After all, this is Gyan Yoga, the yoga of knowledge, understanding. We are understanding human nature, why people do what they do. We are understanding what takes our peace away. When are we at peace? For example, if I say you are most at peace in deep sleep, why? Because the me and my story is absent in deep sleep. When you are not there is the deepest peace. So one is understanding this. Ah, yes, of course, this makes sense. So that is part of it.
Okay. And one more thing, I find it actually very difficult to accept this fact, just simply li listening it, that nobody is a doer of what he or she is doing. Like, for a person like me, either I totally reject that and continue with my basic meditation practice and all that, or there's another way around that I keep repeating this thing, try to see life in that dimension and gradually condition my mind that yes, this is happening. And after a certain period of time, my mind start accepting this fact. So is this the right way? Because you are now manipulating the things. Right now, you have no belief in this because you think that you hurt somebody and similarly other hurt you. But just because you want to grow in spiritual path, you are, kind of affirmation, positive suggestion you are giving that nobody is doer. So this seems to me a bit, manipulating and not a very authentic way to proceed, at least for me.
I'm really enjoying your questions. Is this, have you been watching these talks and videos before? Is it your first time?
But this is the first time in a meeting, but I've watched a few of your videos and I read one of the book of Sri Ramesh Balsekar ji, which that time I was not able to comprehend at all. It
Okay.
was like some few years back.
So see, it's very simple. Whether or not you accept or reject the concept of non-doership is God's will.
Okay.
Because you also have been given a set of genetics and conditioning and nature. A concept may appeal to you, it may not appeal to you. You
True.
will use your intellect, you will ask yourself, does this appeal to me or it does not appeal to me? You will accept it or reject it. Simple, very simple.
True.
But in spite of rejecting it, it may creep up slowly, slowly. It could happen that way, that my God, one fine day you're sitting somewhere and you say, really, yeah, if I really look at it, when I think this way, I'm not at peace. But when I think this way, I'm more at peace. For example, if I'm embroiled in the blame game and I'm just consumed by it, I'm not at peace. How could I be at peace? Because my mind is just in overdrive. But if I really think and just look at this new concept which has been presented to me, it's up to me to accept it or reject it. But I look at it, I look at the event in this light, maybe I am given the opportunity in this fresh light to see whether this way of looking at the event is delivering to me peace or not. So I'm open now. I'm not closed. Now I'm open. What has happened is I have had my old conditioning, childhood conditioning, conditioning prior to listening to these talks. Then I have the new conditioning. Now, whether my mind starts thinking this way or not is God's will. I may be completely shut out. So I stay with my old conditioning and I'm happy with it. Or I find by and by things happen in life, situations come up, and sometimes I'm reminded of these words. I'm reminded of, hey, look here. This guy told you what he did based on a lot of factors. So just look, reconsider things. This inner voice may come up sometimes. Then you have to decide. Decision is yours. Do I listen to it or I don't listen to it?
Actually, what my mind says is that the moment you accept this fact, you get a relief from a lot of burden which right now you are taking. That's for sure. But I'm a bit fearful also that maybe it may be I'm misleading my mind. I'm just moving away from what the fact is. So this duality is going on within me.
Of course,
One more.
because you see, the very important thing is happening here. The ego is losing its control. The ego is losing its dominion. You see, that is what is happening. It's very important. I thought I was in control of my life, situations in my life, and also in control of other people in my life. So it's very scary for the ego, you see, because we are pulling out the foundation beneath it. We are exposing it. So the ego is going to put up a fight. It does not want to dissolve.
And one more fear that maybe accepting this, I would be more vulnerable. That is also there.
Yes, of course. And you will be more vulnerable. To what? To God's will. You see, because the ego has been protecting and defending itself since childhood. This is me. I don't want to die. What does I don't want to die mean? All what I am identified with, my precious views and opinions about life, if that is threatened, it's a fear. Because the ego is identified with all that. I really don't want to die. So I'm always defending myself with people. I'm defending my opinion, my views, my judgments. And then I'm forcing them on others. Whereas I can just listen to someone and say, all right, this is your view. Would you care to hear my view? If you care to hear my view, I'll express it. Because now I am no longer identified so strongly. Because I can see the hand of God behind it all. So I'm no longer trying to convince others because I know I'm not right. I know mine is a point of view and theirs is another point of view. So you see this battle, this conflict, I'm not engaging in anymore. So in that sense, I'm more vulnerable, you could say. So be it. What is wrong with it? What is bad about it? Aren't you vulnerable in deep sleep?
Yeah.
So it's scary.
The difference is, but the difference is that time you are not conscious. This entire problem arises when you are conscious of everything. In deep sleep, we are not conscious.
Exactly.
So can't help it.
And so that is why the spiritual journey is really a beautiful gift, because it is a journey of getting more and more conscious in the waking state.
Mm-hmm.
It's so beautiful, actually. The sheer fact that you are talking like this, asking these questions, means there has been a shift away from the mundane. There's a shift towards understanding, hey, what's going on? What am I accepting? What am I rejecting? Now I'm consumed by this. It's like a fire, you see. It's the fire has been ignited. And it's the fire of knowledge, of right understanding. And it will burn brightly.
Can I ask one more question last?
Okay.
Like, in the background of all this, how we would correlate this with the theory of karma and prarabdha? When
that
I'm not a doer.
We need a whole nother satsang for.
Okay. No problem.
And we've spoken about it before. We'll definitely go into it, but let's give others a chance this time.
Sure.
But I really enjoyed your questions. Where are you based?
I'm from Gwalior, sir. I mailed you also a few days back, if you remember.
Oh.
I mailed you that I've been reading J. Krishnamurti for last 15-20 years, trying to understand what he's saying, following meditation suggested by Raman Maharshi, Who Am I?
Okay.
And acceptance is one thing which I find really difficult, because what I am more inclined towards is to see the reality the way it is.
Yes.
Without accepting, without rejecting. And
fair enough.
That path inclined me more.
Okay.
I got a reply from you also.
Okay.
But satsang-wise, I always wanted to talk to you, but this is the first time I got an opportunity.
Okay, great. Hope to have you again.
Sure. My pleasure.
Yes, Advaita. That's a nice name.
Actually, I think this is the first time I have logged in. So I think somehow the name got changed.
Oh, it was a mistake.
Yeah, it was a mistake. So my name is Ishwar, better than Advaita.
I'm in good company.
Yeah. So me too. I feel the same. So my question is, I want to be everybody who is in path of this spiritual journey. Going into Advaita, they will obviously go into a different stream, as the earlier participant was saying. He refers to J. Krishnamurti, or maybe Ramana Maharshi, or maybe for that matter, Bhagavad Gita. So there are so many sources nowadays because of a digital world. As you said that, these are distractions, but in a way we get to access of all these because earlier without this, I think it was very difficult to get all these accesses and then clarify yours. So in this path, in this age, I think everybody who is in this path, they would have gone to all this. So then it will come to where the application of it, right? So in my daily life, how I would able to apply it, and so that I will be a better person tomorrow or maybe right now. So for that matter, now we are in this class, we are teaching that inaction or maybe everything, whatever is happening, is by God's will. So by that matter, the person would may also get a lazy person, right? Means he thinks that, okay, everything is God's will, I don't have to work, right? Means I'm just giving one example, but not in that fashion. But somebody also said that I will feel guilty and all that stuff. So everything combined together, how we would be able to justify ourselves that suppose I'll give you an example. There is a person who is definitely doing evil, but we are thinking that that person is also correct because of this path, right? Because it is his conditioning. So nobody is an other person who is a doer. Then how do we defeat that person, and how I'll take that action that
Well,
I need to.
Ishwar, the whole Bhagavad Gita is about this. So this misunderstanding, what you're saying is a gross misunderstanding of the ego, which is what Krishna told Arjuna when he said, I am not going to kill my preceptors, and he puts his bow down. This is itself the misunderstanding, you see. Obviously, if someone is perceived as doing evil, and history has shown us many such characters, people have risen up against it. What is this teaching saying? As Krishna told Arjuna, dear Arjuna, you are born to be a warrior, trained to be a warrior, your entire conditioning is that of a warrior, but you think you are the doer. There lies the problem. Whereas I, as time, Krishna, as time, have already killed them. So this overthinking, which is what the ego does, that there'll be inaction, then let everyone is an aspect of God, let them do what they want. This is not what the teaching is saying. What the teaching is saying is, when the sense of doership is understood and is no longer attributed to a person's action, there's objectivity. You still have to face a situation and do precisely that which you think and feel you should do. If someone is perpetrating evil acts, obviously, if I have the resources, I will take a call and do what I can. But I'm no longer blaming individuals. You see, I'm dealing with the situation. I have the full understanding that even this is an aspect of God. It doesn't mean I like it. It doesn't mean I accept it. It doesn't mean there's inaction on my part. This is the entire Gita is on this. And if you've seen the other videos, or if you've read some of my books, this part is very clearly explained. Yes?
Yeah, I get it. So you are saying in a way that we shouldn't be looking as a person we are responding to, but we would say that we are responding to a situation is what we have to understand and then proceed.
Yes, so look at your own life. I am sure, like you, like me, we all have people who push our buttons more than others, you know,
Yeah,
someone who
yeah.
triggers us. Let's look at those people. So it's not about inaction on our part. All we are saying is, please understand where this person is coming from. We don't know how their consciousness has been shaped, what experiences they had in childhood, what trauma they faced. But they are doing and saying things bases all that. So when we approach it this way, that when that person pushes your buttons, now with this understanding, you're just dealing with the situation, not with he is doing this to me and I hate him for that. That dialogue goes. When I see that this too is precisely the way it was meant to be, my focus is no longer on the individual doing something to me. So I'm more objective. I will find now that I don't react, I rather respond, because my reactions were knee-jerk reactions based on the past, constant action, reaction. Now I am more sthir, I'm more accepting of the person the way God made them, yet I will say and do what I have to do. That changes the whole. The whole rin changes, the bandhan, the bondage takes on a different quality now because we are no longer perpetuating it all the time. One person may be constantly at it, But like I always say, to stop a tennis match, only one player needs to keep the racket down.
Yeah,
So,
but is it not that I'm accepting the defeat and running away from the situation,
I
like
don't know if
by
you are accepting it or not, or running away. It all depends what you have decided to say to the person. You're still free to say and express your point of view. It doesn't mean keeping quiet. But when the sting of doership is removed from the equation, you will find that the words you use, the things you say, are not as sharp, as hurtful to the other. Because an individual is not being targeted. That is the difference which happens. And therefore, you are more at peace with what has happened.
In general, if I can say that people like now coming to the other part of it, like in this material world, right? The people who have achieved more financially or whatever, right? So it comes to where that we people associating with Advaita or maybe in spiritual path won't be reaching those levels, or maybe since our thinking is that accept whatever is coming your way. So how do you see that it is like we and the others who are actually who are already they have achieved what they wanted to, so they will never come into this life by coming into this path of knowledge and all stuff, right? So how do you see that this difference of our thinking, how they have achieved and how we are going into this path. Like in our way, we think that, okay, we are missing, we are actually not going in that path, because it's not that it is bad, right? Because like people who are achieved so much, they are feeding so many mouths as well. It's not that something they are bad doing, right? They have got it, but they are simultaneously distributing it to the so large numbers as well. So there is always one, there is one question is there, there is a conflict is happening, right? So how do we come out with some very clear answer to this and then proceed ahead of it?
I can't understand where the conflict is, quite frankly. Whether a person is leading a multi-million dollar organization or a person is employed, there's no difference. That all the teaching is doing is delivering peace of mind to you. Why this comparing and judging and so on and so forth? I could be immersed in the teaching and still successfully run a very big company. So I'm not getting the point which you're trying to make.
I mean to say, I have not at least not come across any examples like where we are in this path and that person is achieved whatever now currently we are seeing in this current lot, right? Or maybe whatever the lots we have seen reaching to that level, or maybe that highest level, whatever in our era, right?
But
So
I
how
don't
do
know.
you?
I don't know how you're saying that. In fact, in my own guru's time, I have met one of the top three lawyers in Sweden used to come to him regularly. Multi-millionaires who had businesses in the US would come to him. So I don't know how you feel these are very separate things. I don't think they are. In
Okay.
fact, I think this understanding and this teaching would make for better ways to manage big organizations and so on and so forth. I too have received emails and messages from people who are doing extremely well in life. I don't think the two are disconnected. That's not my experience. Yes, in one sense, that when one's priority is Sukha Shanti, it could appear that the mundane world, the material world, is not that fascinating anymore. That is for those people. But someone who is driven to lead a company of, let's say, 300 people, that is their nature, does not mean they get isolated from the teaching. All right. So I don't think we have more time today. So I'm just going to switch the view to gallery so I can see you all. Just sit in silence for a minute or two. And in fact, I am reminded of, I forget the name of this industry, this very successful businessman in the US who just found it very easy to make money and loved making money. And with all the, he sold his company for millions of dollars. And he went to his guru in South India. He was a foreigner. He was abroad. And he said, this is how much I've made, $300 million or whatever. And I just want to keep $5 million for myself. And I have $295 million to give away. I'm just mentioning numbers, but that's the gist of it. And the guru said, all right, what can we do? And thought about it and said, okay, let's build a hospital. And they built a hospital with all that money. And the point here is, it was that man's nature to be a businessman. He honored it, made his millions, knew his limits, had his guru, and was happy to give it away. So it is not that this teaching kills one's innate nature or buries it and makes one become inactive, lethargic. No such thing. Who said? I mean, in fact, the opposite happens. Imagine if you're running an organization where you see everyone in it as an aspect of God, the way God created them. You will no longer be nasty to your employees. You'll no longer push them around. You will know everyone is doing their best. If they aren't, I speak to them. If it doesn't work out for my organization, I tell them bye-bye. But I'm not blaming and condemning them for not fulfilling their tasks. I understand it was not destined. So be it. So be it. So be it. So be it. That becomes my mantra. So be it. I find I no longer reject outright what someone says. I find I say, is it so? Because I'm seeing this person's expression is equally valid as my expression. I may not agree with it. I may have a differing point of view. But it is equally valid because the consciousness in you and the consciousness in me is not two. Imagine it's the same electricity running through all the gadgets in the kitchen. Imagine in my life thinking that the consciousness in this bugger, in this fellow, is different from the consciousness in me. The electricity in him is different from the electricity in me. Do you see how absurd this is? It is really the theater of the absurd. And when we realize this absurdity of it all, we honor and respect points of view which may be contrary to ours. Doesn't mean we agree with them. Doesn't mean we hate them for their point of view. We agree to disagree. That's all. We agree to disagree without being disagreeable, is what my teacher would say. Which means what? Which means I have a tough meeting with someone. We don't agree on anything. And after it, I say, hey, it's time for my peppermint tea. Would you like to join and have a tea with me? Let's go down to the club. Yours is an intimate relationship with everyone who appears in your life, because they're all appearing within your own consciousness. All the labels you have stuck on everyone's forehead, all aspects of that one consciousness only. Point is, are we polarized all the time between those we like and those we don't like? Or do we see the one behind it all? This teaching marks the end of polarization. I'm no longer swinging like a pendulum between the extremes of duality, but rather the still point, Buddha's middle path, the point of equilibrium, is reached, and that point delivers nothing but peace and harmony in daily living. Thank you.